Warning: this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Glasses Manifesto.
I poured out my heart to the guy, told him how guilty I was, and he knew about this all the time. He says, I knew about it. The important thing is that you finally realized it. You see, I could have told you this long ago, but you didn't want to hear it. And he realized, too, that I couldn't face it then. You know, I couldn't accept my own guilt.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, a true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story. If not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 19. Giving Up, Son of Sam. Act 1. I may have fibbed about a few things. Once David Berkowitz was in prison, serving 6 consecutive life sentences with no chance of parole, he began with the shocking ease of an institutionalized man settling into life in prison despite never having set so much as a big toe inside a prison, jail, or juvenile facility ever before in his entire life. Strangely satiated and seemingly soothed by life on the inside, David Berkowitz was no longer drowning in a sea comprised entirely of his own wildly out of control emotional triggers, which he found to be ever present on the outside. There were no more neighbors with impossibly loud television sets, no more inconsiderate dogs separating him from his much needed rest, no more low wage jobs locking him into an endless struggle for survival, and perhaps, most importantly, he was no longer suffering under the unrealistic expectation of a life filled with meaningful emotional relationships with both men and women. A life he knew he could never experience. David Berkowitz was now a prisoner, and by virtue of that fact, very little was expected of him. He had, in one fell swoop, erased all pressures of his previous life by answering all its myriads of impossible questions with one all-encompassing and endlessly resounding answer. Prison. And obviously it goes without saying that prison, for most, beyond being incredibly dangerous on a number of levels, has got to be, at the very least, annoying as hell. As it is, no doubt, chocked full to the teeth with the most rowdy, noisy, angry, aggressive, and inconsiderate people on the planet. I cannot tell you why David Berkowitz seemed to find so much comfort in prison life, but he did. However, all the triggers prison seemed quiet for him were, after all, external. And as anyone who's done more than a few therapy sessions knows, there is no external factor that can give you peace on the inside. And so it was that just a few months into his 360-year prison sentence, David Berkowitz was about to learn that with all the external comfort that prison seemed to bring, came a new kind of torment, one of self-examination. Permanently separated from the life he had known on the outside, David Berkowitz was now left alone on the inside with his own conscience in an equally permanent way. And that was an altogether uncomfortable place to be. On the outside, while of course motivated by internal forces, his gaze had been firmly focused on what enraged him and what others were or weren't doing, attention he was or wasn't getting. Now that he was no longer living in a world comprised entirely of his own triggers, he wasn't constantly distracted by them anymore. Now that David Berkowitz was in a situation that more or less worked for him, he was threatened with the thoughtful introspection that peace and quiet bring. And this was a major problem for two reasons. The first involved what it was that he was left alone to look at. David Berkowitz had violently attacked 16 people. And while I do not believe that David has the kind of developed conscience that most of us have, I do not believe he is totally without feeling. And this feeling, or what was left of it, was beginning to eat away at him. The second was the simple fact that no one was paying attention to him anymore. And by January of 1978, it seemed as though the world was moving on without him. In the previous year and a half, the Son of Sam murders had turned the whole world on its head. And while it had, David Berkowitz had been at the center of it all. And now, that was all over. And the way he saw it was that it was up to him to get it back. But when you're in prison, there's a lot you can't do on your own. So if you want something done, you have to get someone else to do it for you, which oddly caters perfectly to a group of people already especially capable and practiced at the art of manipulation. And so it was that David Berkowitz, enlisting the help of Dr. David Abrahamson, the psychiatrist who found Berkowitz competent to stand trial at his second competency hearing, set about giving up the Son of Sam story, as he had done officially at the press conference the year before, but for realsies this time.
And all up to him around January of 1978, after I was already in prison. I fought him to the end, Abrahamson, knowing he was right, but getting encouragement from these other doctors that I was sick, and from my defense attorneys, the two little shysters, you know. You know, you're sick, come on, sick. You know, you're insane. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. I wanted to believe myself crazy because I couldn't face my own guilt. It was after I got here to prison, after I went from Wassey to the routine examinations and wound up here working, you know, and I got adjusted to this other inmates, you know, had the social rapport with them, you know, just basic stuff. And then but my conscience was still troubling me because outside, around, everybody says, well, you know, they got this whole demon thing built up to tremendous proportions, you know. And while I adjusted well, my conscience was really tearing me apart because I knew the whole story. And it was on the tip of my tongue. I wanted to tell someone, but who? Who would listen? Who would care? Another inmate? They wouldn't have the slightest interest, you know.
Not only would they have no interest, they also wouldn't have the ability to communicate his story to the outside world, just as he didn't. David is no dummy after all. He understood that a psychologist, given an opportunity like this one, would, more than likely, want to write a book on the subject. And in that case, by some circuitous route, he would inadvertently be one of its authors.
I didn't question him about the reasons for asking to have Dr. Abrahamson counsel him, but it could be that sense of failure and needing a scientific voice to back up and put his life story out there in a meaningful way, which is why I think he also agreed to talk to me.
So there you have it. In addition to the healing the sessions may bring, David Berkowitz seemed aware, at least on some level, that they may also be useful in serving the other prong in his dual set of purposes, i.e. getting back in the press and staying, quote-unquote, important to society at large, which fed his narcissism and made him feel a little bit better about what he had done. Not to say that there wouldn't also be some legitimate self-examination going on here as well, some incredibly necessary peeling back of the layers the Son of Sam mythology had buried him in, not to mention the layers that had been built in the preceding years. I just want to point out that David's motives to do or not do something were very rarely cut and dry, or even completely known to him. David was, after all, a pretty sick man, and had backed himself into quite a corner with the whole talking dog thing. I mean, it had been his great and glorious shield, providing the perfect cover to hide behind for quite a while. And now it was time to give all that up, and he saw Dr. Abrahamson as the perfect person to help him do just that.
I poured out my heart to the guy, told him how guilty I was, and he knew about this all the time. He says, I knew about it. The important thing is that you finally realized it. You see, I could have told you this long ago, but you didn't want to hear it. And he realized, too, that I couldn't face it then. You know, I couldn't accept my own guilt. And he realized, too, that these doctors, with all their feedback encouraging me to go on with it, the demon thing didn't make any matters any easier, you know.
David Berkowitz needed, as he always did, the perfect foil. And he found that foil in Dr. Abrahamson.
He had clearly formed a bond with Abrahamson after coming clean with him and begun, maybe to his credit, to think more logically about things, if not more altruistically, as he indicated he was trying to do, and that maybe by going through further psychiatric consultation, this would give more credibility to his voice as a more clear-headed spokesman for victims' rights, and there again ennoble him in the way that the taxi driver character in the end became congratulated and admired for. Even though doing a horrible thing, it had helped society at large in a greater way.
If David Berkowitz could be one of the unofficial authors of Dr. Abrahamson's book, maybe he could also be one of its heroes. I mean, he was, after all, by virtue of his being a murderer, one who could uniquely supply inside information as to why someone would do something like this. And hell, who knows? Maybe information like that could even save lives. And wouldn't he, in that case, be a hero rather than a villain? Or at the very least, a hero in addition to a villain. I think this notion, perhaps murkily at first, began to appear in David's mind as the two traveled deeper into his past, putting together the pieces that would ultimately form a serial killer. And this notion that he could somehow come out a hero in all this became one of his primary motivations.
He came up about four or five times after that. Spent about 3 or 4 hours here talking, you know. And I wrote him constantly, you know, getting all my confessions and everything, all my thoughts down on paper, you know.
It was a long series of interviews in which he divulged all of his memories from childhood in an effort to unravel the reasons that anyone could begin to understand why he had become so angry and so driven within himself since such an early age to a point of alienation that he felt had to be expressed through the murder of innocent humans.
The pair began to examine David's life before the murders, stretching back to childhood, something that, according to David, had never been done by any of his previous doctors, and this, to David, made all the difference.
I feel like you owe a lot to Dr. Abrahamson for
I do.
Making it possible to be honest with yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's helped me to see myself as I really am. He's helped me to become more mature so I could be mature enough to see what things I had done wrong, you know, not try to hide behind them and make these fibs or something, you know.
Jack asked David if he ever believed any of it.
Was there ever any time that you felt like the devil was actually tormenting you, using you, working through you?
Well, I had tried desperately to convince myself that this was the case. This is what I wanted to believe in order to keep my own sanity. The guilt, you see, was so overpowering that if I would have gone crazy altogether, it would have been from the guilt, not from this this demon business, which was played up by the media. I had the only reason for this demon story was to offset my own guilt you know, to hang a type of justification for my crimes, you know, a mental justification or something. You know, it's not me that's doing this, folks. It's the devil. He's just working through me. I'm a victim too. And this is what I try to portray to others and mostly to myself.
I don't believe that was the only purpose it served. The demon story, in addition to helping assuage his guilt, also had the additional benefit of being a pretty damn good way to psych himself up to commit the murders, once he realized he wasn't going to get caught right away. Initially, I think he was operating on rage alone, and thought that after the first couple attacks, he'd be caught and that would be that. But when that didn't happen, he needed something else to hang his hat on, so to speak. But still, in the end, whatever realizations he did or didn't come to, David Berkowitz was happy to give the credit to Dr. Abrahamson.
I'd say Abrahamson helped a great deal, because he, I was, as I told you before, I knew the truth, you know, the motivations and things. I knew the demon story was all nonsense and that I wasn't insane. I wasn't mentally ill, and I tried to, I couldn't face my own guilt, and I realized he knew it all the time, and I just started to confess everything to him, and you'd be surprised how beneficial that is.
So it's pretty clear that David Berkowitz liked and felt comfortable with Dr. Abrahamson, and to that end, it can't be ignored that one of the key reasons Berkowitz felt so comfortable with Abrahamson was that Abrahamson did not think David was insane, and had testified to as much in court, which resulted in David being found competent to stand trial, which in the end was what he wanted. Once David had been found insane by the doctors that initially examined him, he immediately realized that he had taken the whole demon thing too far, and that being labeled insane was not a good thing for him, since it took him out of the driver's seat and undermined everything he had done. Everything he wanted to take credit for. I mean, after all, wasn't he the criminal mastermind that eluded a special task force comprised of 200 officers and detectives for over a year? If they labeled him insane, he wouldn't be able to take credit for that, and it would become just a coincidence that it had taken so long to catch him due to the fact that a quote-unquote crazy person wouldn't be able to orchestrate something like that. So once he crossed that line, he was done with it for good, and began, at that moment, feverishly scrambling to get back on the other side, completely sane and in control, ready to take credit for everything he had done, forever, for all time. Still, Jack asked David if there was ever a time he was tempted to go back to the demon story.
Was there ever any time when you got scared, when you wanted to run and hide behind the demon cover again or something?
No. Once it was out, they couldn't keep me shut, because it was bottled up for so long, it just had to all come out. I had to pour out my conscience and admit that this was just a big nothing. And I just had to confess everything and roll with the punches or whatever.
And now that he had openly admitted to everything he had done, he was, as he saw it, perfectly situated to dispense advice on both murder and murderers, conveniently making him the ultimate social justice warrior, uniquely equipped to help others avoid people like him. So that's just what he did. He offered advice freely, openly, and unsolicited. And one of the interesting and often upsetting aspects of that is that the advice he had to give wasn't altogether terrible. The first thing he wants us to do is learn from his mistakes.
For people to blame these demons or something, or satanic henchmen, that's the way the devil would want it, you know, because if there was a devil, you know what I'm saying? Because that would cover over, you know, blaming these invisible creatures for all the wrongs in society and prevents people from trying to look at things intelligently. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And he said, we waste all our time. Well, there's nothing we can do about it because these were demons that did it. We don't try to study anything because we accepted some invisible demons were responsible for everything.
And it's not that he isn't right. It's just that with David Berkowitz, there's always one hand doing one thing and the other hand doing another. So it's always a story of what both hands are doing, which are very rarely the same thing. Unless, of course, that thing is hurting people.
I think that the science of mental health therapy had begun to dawn on him as something valuable, and he was seeing honest reasons for what he did, struggling to feel the shame that he should have felt all along. He was, at that time, very much a proponent of being honest with oneself, as opposed to, I was tempted, this is not me ordinarily, I'm a good guy, I help people, but the devil and the temptation were too great, and I did this thing, I sinned against God, I injured another human being, I killed innocent people. In the final analysis, it was really easy to try to shift the blame to supernatural forces. And there's a great market for that because it's what a lot of people, if not most people, want to believe. You know, we've all sinned and come short of the glory of God, I think is the biblical quotation. And it's much easier if we can repent, feel that we've been saved or forgiven. And it was the devil's fault. The only problem is the devil is here inside us.
And speaking of what's inside, I do not want to leave you with the idea that David Berkowitz played Dr. Abrahamson. If anything, it was the other way around. Although it would seem that Dr. Abrahamson's motivations were more or less on the level. I think it's clear that Abrahamson wanted to write a book, because he did. It's called Confessions of Son of Sam, and it was published in 1985. And I gotta say, the story in that book is by far the closest version of the story to the one told in David's interview with Jack, around which this podcast is based, that's out there on the subject. And by a long stretch. Although, I don't think many have read it. It's an excellent book, but since it was intended to be a clinical study of a murderer, in order to educate society about how such a person could be avoided, might have put it off the summer reading list for many. Still, I highly recommend it. But beyond wanting to write a book, I think Abrahamson legitimately wanted to help Berkowitz. And I think that he did, as much as anyone could. And I think that because, in addition to uncovering the elements in his life that certainly play into Berkowitz's motivations going back to an early age, motivations covered in this podcast via Jack's interview with Berkowitz, Abrahamson got Berkowitz to a place which he doesn't visit in his interview with Jack, a place that I feel is really at the beating heart of all of this. Now, Abrahamson did not record his interview. He didn't believe in that, but he did take notes, and what follows are a collection of quotes that Abrahamson jotted down during their many conversations. The first of which probably gets to the point the fastest. Quote, he had fantasized about shooting women for a long time, and he knew it was going to be pretty women, end quote. Berkowitz explains further the relationship between his sexual feelings about women and his feelings about violence. Quote, I do fantasize about women, and my fantasies are not violent. That is, when I'm making love to them in these daydreams, I envision myself as a lover who is passionate, well-endowed, and is able to please my mate by giving her a multitude of orgasms. When I fantasize myself having sex with a woman, it's never violent. But in my mind, sometimes I do have the desire to cause bodily harm, but not while having sex. My violent fantasies are miles apart from my heterosexual fantasies. These are restless dreams. When I wake up, the cover is off. In my dreams, I see a couple of my victims. The girl looks very attractive, end quote. So there it is. While Berkowitz denies that his lifelong desire to commit violence against women is sexual in nature, he does admit that his sexual feelings and his longing for violence are, at the very least, holding hands. And that's as far as I think anyone will get with David Berkowitz. Act 2. it'll be you that pays the price. While David seems to be pretty much full of nice things to say about Dr. Abrahamson, he makes it pretty clear that he does not feel the same way about the doctors that initially examined him, and voices his disdain through a fairly passive-aggressive lens.
I feel sorry for the doctors, the three doctors that said, like, I was criminally insane, you know, definitely demented, a lunatic, deranged, you know, because, well, I don't want to embarrass them or anything, because they were nice guys, you see. But if society were to go along with them and claim that what I did was that, or claim that I am just an insane lunatic because they didn't understand offhand my motives, you see, my hidden or repressed feelings or emotions or whatever, you see, that were below the surface. You can't see that. They didn't understand the motives. So immediately they want to just stamp on my head, criminally insane, and toss me off to a madhouse with drugs, living amongst drugs, psychotics, and straitjackets and things. That's not the answer. That's only passing the buck, you see. But what society has to do in order to benefit from this tragedy is simply to sit down and try to piece it all together, which is what I've tried to do with Dr. Abrahamson, you see.
Talk about passing the buck. He's basically saying, in no uncertain terms, that if the doctors who initially examined him would have succeeded in convincing the court of their initial diagnosis, that society at large would have missed out on all he had to offer, all of his quote-unquote wisdom. And while I do think there are ways in which we as a society can benefit by listening to David, I do believe his position here is a little overstated. And although it's really nice he, quote, doesn't want to embarrass his doctors, it's hard not to see his comments here as just another act of aggression, a thinly veiled threat.
That's sort of a childish threat. If you punish me, if you don't give me attention, you're going to be sorry. If you don't listen to what I'm saying about the Son of Sam law and see the good that has come out of the evil that I've done, you're going to miss an opportunity to stop somebody else from doing what I've done. Yeah, that's a very egomaniacal threat that he's throwing down. Pay attention to me or you're going to be sorry.
And while that statement may be true, it clearly serves other purposes as well. Not to mention the fact that the last person in the world you want to hear any of this from is David Berkowitz.
I think it's a mechanism, again, to show that he is intelligent and in control and not like someone who wants to be mislabeled and somehow conveniently pigeonholed and dismissed. If we can say, oh, the guy was just crazy, then we can stop thinking about them. You know, we've got them in a category. But he's saying that I and most of us who cross that line and murder innocent people are far more than that. We are special. We are not a label. We are not a diagnosis. We're unique and we need to be given attention before, if possible, but certainly after our crimes. Pathological narcissism is, you know, a well-known element among this group.
Jack asked David his reaction to people who feel he no doubt must be crazy due to the fact that he murdered a bunch of innocent people for no apparent reason.
Easy reaction from people is, the guy's nuts. He's got to be nuts.
Right.
He's got to be crazy. Nobody in their right mind would go around killing people.
And this is
how
this,
do you answer that?
Right, this view is like, that for people to have that view, the harm is going to be for themselves. Because if they don't understand, they can't figure the guy out, they just stamp on him, well, he must be criminally insane, and they just send him off somewhere. Okay, he needs to be confined. You know, I'm not saying I'm not supposed to be here. I definitely need to be here, you know. I should spend my whole life here for what I've done. But if nobody's going to learn anything, then those victims died in vain. You see?
Again, conveniently, it's someone else's responsibility. This time, society's, to figure out just what exactly is going on with him. And if the threat of future violence wasn't enough, he also throws in the accusation that the meaningfulness of the deaths of the individuals he himself murdered also hangs in the balance. And while this is obviously complete bullshit, specifically in regard to any high horse David Berkowitz might feel he is on or is concerned about falling off of, I do agree that there is something here we can all learn from. and that labeling someone insane isn't going to help us get there.
The easiest thing that the psychiatrist do, including the first couple who interviewed him, was buy into the insanity defense, attributing everything to demons. And that's the easy way out, to label these guys schizophrenic and lock them away for life without making an effort to understand the behavioral forces that played a major role, even though their main reason for these murders was something they were born with.
I think people can learn a lot from this sort of thing.
And that's why I'm trying to tell them. I'm trying to explain to them somehow to get rid of this idea of just branding someone insane, because this is what the people did 300 years ago in these witch trials here. They just couldn't understand any bizarre behavior, and they just ready to cast a person off. But the situation is too grave, and there are too many innocent lives at stake to just simply say, well, you know, we really can't try to figure this out, because I think this nation as a whole should be concerned about it. The random violence is rampant, and you've got to certainly come up with some answers besides, you know, just aggression. You learn how to deal with it, you know. Not only mass murders, but just random violence altogether.
His attempt to minimize the violent attacks he perpetrated on 16 people, six of which resulted in homicide, as, quote, any bizarre behavior, end quote, is totally disgusting. But it is true that senseless violence is an epidemic problem that we really do need to get to the bottom of.
I totally agree that we need to pay attention and study people like David Berkowitz and the other mass murderers and serial killers in order to learn all we can. There was a time when people didn't even speak the word cancer, and if you're not talking about something, you're not going to study it. Put it in a category of our superstitious sort of religious fears that we used to mislabel and conveniently dismiss things and go on with our lives. These guys need to be studied up to and including the point of opening up their skulls, if necessary, to find out where these particular neurons are misfiring and giving that message, kill.
And so, with Jack set on gleaning any shred of what could possibly be considered insight on why Berkowitz became so consumed by his rage that he committed a string of senseless murders, and Berkowitz set on wringing any sense of importance he could possibly get from the situation, the two men endeavored to peel apart the particular elements of frustration and rage that led to murder. Act 3. We don't all handle frustration the same.
I think everybody has a violent tendencies in them.
I think you're right.
And aggressive tendencies. It's just that how well people can control them. You know, there's certain normal things when you're supposed to, that you do. If somebody stepped on your foot when you're walking in the street, the average person, even if it hurt a little bit, the person would say, oh, excuse me. And even if you're in a hurry or something, you know, it might upset you a little bit. But you don't, you just, all right, you know, it's one of those things that you're walking on a crowded street.
I think that's true. I remember remarking to one of the counselors that I worked with inside Attica all those years ago that there's a little son of Sam in all of us. And with the wrong kind of combination of circumstances, every human being is capable of murder, either in an act of anger, sudden act of anger and emotion, or allowing anger and emotion to build to the point that we do something like he did. And like too many people are doing today, taking these legally owned weapons of mass destruction and gunning down children in their classrooms, or dozens of people at an outdoor concert, or people in their churches, movie theaters. It's a madness that is here in us, and it needs to be confronted.
Everyone has anger inside them to some degree. I think we'd be hard-pressed to refute that. Everyone has felt the urge to act out aggressively, either through word or deed, on some level, at some point, during their lifetime. And while we all, as a species, might share that trait, still, a huge space exists between those that act upon it and those that don't. And this difference is something Berkowitz likes to blame, in classic Berkowitz fashion, on something he refers to as, quote, the buildup.
But it wouldn't be normal if somebody stepped on your foot, you'd pull out a knife and stick it in their belly or something. You see, it's... I think everybody has the anger. It's just they build up, and so we can't control them. We don't want to control them. Feel the need to get revenge. It's almost, it's a childish thing, really.
The impulse to act on your emotional triggers is indeed childish. But the damage done in doing so is very real, very adult, and must be accounted for, not pushed aside and blamed on, quote, the buildup. First the devil made him do it, now it's the buildup.
You get people pushed off the subways in New York left and right, and just for, not for, you know, anything other than just aggression. People angry and going to work or something, or not finding a job. You know, a guy might have been on his visit to the 50th employment agency or the 50th company to apply for a job, and they dejected once more, rejected, or given the same line, well, don't call us, we'll call you, we'll let you know. Discuss it with everything. For some reason, it just triggers this impulse thing, you know, without any real planning to any degree. See somebody on a train station, all the anger and frustration build up at once. Maybe that person resembles somebody or something that maybe they're not even aware of. It could be something subconscious. And as the train's coming in, they just, bing, push the person off the platform and run. They're gone. Cops can't figure out anything. The person is either crippled or dead. And society's all outraged, oh my God, you know, bring back the death penalty or something. It's so silly. People really have to get their heads together and sort this thing out, you know.
This is where the social justice warrior stuff comes in. I know more. I can provide insight. Societal factors cause this to happen. Which might, of course, be true in some regard, especially as it involves reforming societal issues that cause people undue stress, but overall seems to be specifically designed to sidestep one incredibly important factor: personal responsibility.
The responsibility is to recognize it and to control it. There are people like Berkowitz who never learn that and never really want to learn that. They find some lurid, probably sexually linked autoerogenous pleasure in turning back to their own darkness rather than making much of an effort to link up with the rest of us humans who also struggle and also have our dark moments, but work through them because we either fear the consequences or we have a more balanced innate sense of what's right and what's wrong and the terrible things that happen when you make the conscious decision he said he made. Although he knew where that line of moral insanity lay to push across that line.
And in the end, it at least appears that this decision to push across that line, rather than having the responsibility, strength, and wherewithal to withstand his frustrations, is something he feels makes him special rather than defective.
It's just we all can't handle them the same. We're not mass-produced to perform the same way in the same situation. People, you see them coming to work, and you don't think, you know, you see them on the highways all coming into work, but you don't think about the individuals, you know? You just see masses of people coming in. Each person is a different personality, and that night before, that guy might have just been told that his wife was having an affair, or one of his kids might have gotten arrested for possession of drugs at school, or maybe one guy is just ready to get evicted because he can't meet the payments on his rent, and you just see a mess of faces, but each person's got their own problems, and they're bringing them into work, their own frustrations, and they're living with them day to day. All these pressures mounting, and then some small, seemingly superficial event is just going to happen, a trivial thing, and then everything's going to blow up, you know. The person's going to say, I've had it, you know, go berserk, or something like the Texas Tower, you know, what built it up? What would the motivations be? We don't know, you know. Well, it must have been something. It's not just cold-bloodedness. Something was troubling the man, you know.
We're not all programmed to handle frustration the same.
Of course not.
Well, the guy looked at me wrong. And so I shot him. Then people say, well, he's got to be crazy. Who would do that? He's insane. No, that's not the case. You see, it wasn't that one incident. It was just like a final buildup, you know? It's like putting the cherry on top of a sundae. You understand what I'm saying?
What's the old proverb about the straw that breaks the camel's back? And murders such as his, there was a lifetime buildup of frustration and anguish and being lied to about the fundamentals of his own birth, his own coming into the world, about the nature of death that he continued to be fascinated by and struggle with. But a final buildup sounds a lot like the way you might describe a movie script. If you're writing a fantasy of your own life, let's build the scene where Robert De Niro character decides to take the gun and bring on this cleansing rain that's going to purge his conscience and result in a moral reckoning of some kind for society at large.
It wasn't me, it was the final buildup, which was, in the end, a buildup that happened almost entirely in his own mind, constructed specifically to justify doing something he had already wanted to do.
He had a very privileged childhood. He had every opportunity that almost any child could wish for. There was no physical abuse. All of the anger and frustration he describes going through as a child, by his own analysis, came from within himself. This urge to live this double life he lived. On the surface, as a mild-mannered postal clerk, taxi driver, working guy, army veteran, and when left alone, returning to this darkness, which resulted in the final buildup to crossing the line, becoming the Son of Sam killer.
In the end, having done exactly what he wanted to, he attempts to have his cake and eat it as well by claiming the role of the quote-unquote good guy, in an effort to swing back to a center he can never swing back to.
Despite, you know, all the crimes, I'm not that cold-blooded, you know. I don't think I am. The crimes are definitely cold-blooded, you know. In that period of my life, I committed cold-blooded crimes, but I don't think as a whole I'm cold-blooded, because I knew I was doing wrong, and my conscience was, you know, bothering me, you know, the guilt, right?
That's very convenient and easy to say after you have killed someone in cold blood. I wish I hadn't done that. Oh, Mom, I'm sorry. I'm not really a bad guy, because see what I'm doing right now? They've named a law for crime victims after me, and I'm supporting that all the way. I'm doing all I can to publicize that. I'm not cold-blooded. I care about people. I just couldn't help myself when I killed 6 people and crippled another 7.
Here, I have a list. Right? I typed these 2 pages up the other day. And, you know, if you can, I want you to read that. I have a list here of a lot of guys that I knew just off the top of my head who were responsible for various crimes, you see. But over here is a list of all the men that have committed the so-called multiple murders, or as the media says, mass murders, right? Mm-hmm. And I say here, really, we do need some answers. We need them desperately and soon. Also, this isn't a matter that it can't be taken too light. I'm trying to read this upside down. Then it lists all those guys, and my argument is, while that's only a handful of guys that you can probably count on your fingers, the number of victims go up into the hundreds, you see. And all of these guys were from the last 2 decades, most of them within the last 5 years or so. And we certainly need some answers. These are all these so-called lone mass killers or something. The situation for this nation, not only the state, but the whole nation, it is severe. Because these guys are all over the place. Most people don't really know how severe the situation is until they do something like me and list them all together and start adding up the totals, and you realize the number of innocent victims that have been killed.
Right.
Now, out of all those men, not one of them has really attempted to ever sit down and figure out why he did what he did, you know? They're either playing crazy, or they just packed off to prison, or maybe they just can't communicate well. A guy like Richard Speck, for example, is not an intelligent person. He's not literate, so he can't communicate, and he can't tell anybody anything. Nobody's learned anything, you see? So that's why I'm saying that a society should attempt to try to find an answer. It behooves them to do so.
I think he's absolutely right. It has gotten worse. It's a huge problem, and he is absolutely spot on in that analysis.
I think it's important to remember that David said this in 1980, long before mass shootings were the common occurrence that they are today. But here's where it goes off the rails.
You understand what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
It's something we had better as society as a whole, had better attempt to piece this thing together quick. You see, the view that the people had, like, the guy's got to be nuts, is the exact view, is somewhat like the exact view the people had in Salem, Massachusetts in 1692. Anybody that demonstrated the slightest bizarre behavior, whether they rolled around in the mud in their Sunday best or they sang to themselves continually, these people were suddenly declared to be vexed with devils or something, taken out to the pond and drowned or something, you know? Not only just drowned, but tortured, dunked continually for a couple hours till they were dead in and out of the water, you know? Mm-hmm. And also all types of other barbaric torture things that they set up, you know, 300 years ago or in the day of the witch trials in Europe. And this view that people have today, that somehow because they can't understand what I did, if they just label that insanity, then they've missed everything. They have that same view that those primitive peasants had 300 years ago. You know, those people claimed all those people were possessed by demons and things, when really, most of them had just common cases of mental illness or mental retardation. And from their primitive outlook, they just said that was a case of someone being possessed by evil forces or demons, you see. And so this is my argument, that people are doing that exact same thing today if they just try to write me off as deranged without attempting to understand anything.
While I do agree that it is vitally important not to sweep situations like David's under the rug, or in this case, into a cell, without first administering a healthy and unflinching examination, in order to see what we can all get out of this, I do see the above as yet another attempt to minimize what he did, and collect sympathy if possible by connecting himself to individuals who were victimized in the past. Individuals who in most cases didn't even do anything, but who were singled out due to societal prejudices active at the time. David didn't sing too long or roll around on the ground. He wasn't victimized. He was held accountable for dispensing an unknown amount of pain and suffering on countless people.
I think he's pointing out that societies, tribes, throughout history have been some of the biggest murderers among us through the superstition and fears that have caused us not to study the kind of violence that he wreaked upon innocent humans, but to try to hide it behind either a religious fear, there be witches, you know, we have to find these witches and remove them. And that's the danger of doing what he says, of trying to identify an innocent child and say, this child has that bad seed and is another young son of Sam. If we start doing that, we're doing what the people in Salem did to these innocent young women who they drowned and stoned and supposedly burned as witches. It's the urge to paint oneself as a victim, no matter the reason for their guilt. I want to understand and be honest about what I did and why I did it. But here are the reasons why I'm not maybe fully responsible and why I still deserve to be respected as someone who is still developing. God's not finished with me yet.
Next time on Killer Tape, things go full circle when an attempt is made on David's life.
Never look back. Maybe try to put yourself and the victim's position of just being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, there's nothing I can do about it. I can't say I really thought of it.
What about when the guy came out of the shank?
I knew that I was guilty, and you see, I wasn't really an innocent victim. I suppose that if I wasn't who I was, it wouldn't have happened. Take it, I guess, as best as you could. It's like nothing happened, you know. Like, not that type of person that's got to hide or something. Hide a little bit.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt and Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.